This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show that hopes to illustrate that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done incredible things and endured at times unbelievable conditions, all for the sake of that freedom that you and I enjoy every day as Americans. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price of freedom. And along the way, we are educated, entertained, and sometimes even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is 93-year-old Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California, author of the book, The Gator Navy, the amphibious navy that I knew in World War II. I'll let you know a little later how you can get your hands on it. It is one of those rare occasions when I wasn't able to fit a veteran story into one episode. I had to extend it over two programs. So last week, if you missed the show, you can find it at hometownheroesradio.com. But last week, we heard about how Mr. Killingsworth grew up in the small town of Taft. He was studying for finals at the University of California in Berkeley when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. We heard how once he enlisted in the Navy, a blind date in Virginia led to a marriage that's now at 68 years and counting. And we also heard how he ended up volunteering for dangerous pre-invasion duty at Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands. We left off with Mr. Killingsworth ready to lead landing boats into Saipan in June of 1944. So let's pick up the story right there.
We got into Saipan that morning on the LS2, worked our way up through the ships. There are hundreds and hundreds of ships. The island was afire, smoking, burning. Our battleships had been pounding for days, our cruisers and destroyers, and then we even had gunships that were firing 20 millimeter shells in close. We pulled in there and put our boats in the water and got ready for the landing operation. And as we were getting ready, the cruiser Indianapolis pulled right in the beach where we were supposed to go in, and I thought, this is a disaster. How are we going to get past the ship? And we had never trained to split the wave and go around them. So I took a chance and signaled for the boys to split the wave and go around. And they did. We went on front and aft of the Annapolis and then came back together in front of it. And she fired over our heads while we were going in. I could see these 8-inch shells, 10-inch, whatever they were. They're slow. Their velocity is slow. You can actually see them, you know, going in to the beach ahead of us.
I don't think you ever saw any of those in Taft, did you?
No, I didn't see any of those in Taft. And, of course, the Japanese were looking down from the heights of the mountain, and they had already pre-zeroed in a lot of their guns. And so there were shells exploding all around us as we went in. And I remember, I mentioned in the book, a big 12-inch piece of shrapnel going over the top of our boat, going through the air like that. And I lost two boats going in. I had the first wave that went into the beach, and then the other five waves came in behind me. And we always had an officer in the front and an officer in the back of the wave picking up. So my officer that was behind me, his job was to pick any survivors up. But I think one of the most emotional things that I ever experienced was as we were going in, we were almost to the coral reef. I couldn't, in a landing boat, I couldn't go over the coral reef. So I was to make sure the tractors were on site in the right place, and my job was to turn around once I got them there. So as I was turning around, the Japanese hit two of my tractors as they climbed up on the coral reef. But there was a Marine torpedo bomber who was doing something way beyond the call of duty. It wasn't his place. He didn't have to be there. But he flew right down the coral reef right in front of me, and his gunners were strafing the beach. And the gunner in the back stopped long enough. He turned around, and he waved to the troops. And about that time, a Japanese shell hit the plane. Flipped over, flipped on its back, and disappeared into the ocean. And they brought the bodies up a few days later. But just that split second, as he was waving, he was shot down.
And again, that you just said, that crew didn't need to be there, but they were there to try to support you guys. So it was their lives instead of yours.
Yeah, it was, again, it was beyond the call of duty.
All your stories in your book are so vivid. Some of them run together. Was it Saipan where you also described that the Japanese guns were centered in on a spot in the water right next to you?
This is true. After my initial landing, my job was to go back to control boat where my commanding officer was to see if there were further orders. So since I finished, I went back. As I pulled up alongside the boat, he said, Vic, he said, the Marines are already calling for water and more ammunition and medical supplies. Can you take three boats and go in? I said, sure can. So there was a Marine officer on the control boat that was communicating with the Marines. And he said, I'm going too. And he jumped in my boat with me. And so we took off. And the first one the 27th, I think, was Marine Regiment, also was a backup. They weren't supposed to land in the initial landing, but their casualties were so heavy, they had to bring them in. And so they had their Buffalo's tractors. So we found one of those, and I told the guy, I said, we need to go into the beach. I need to use your Buffalo. He said, sir, I can't do that. He said, my ramp is not working right. So I said, okay. So we went on. We found another one. Again, it was an Army Buffalo. He said, my battery's low. And this Marine colonel said, I'm going to kill SOB. And he started getting his gun out of the holster. And I said, no, let's move on. We'll find a Marine. So we found a Marine alligator. And we pulled up alongside. This kid came out of the driver's side all by himself. There was no crew in there except this one kid. Blood was running down his face. Apparently he had been shot across the forehead. And blood was running down his face. And he said, I didn't steal it, sir, said to the Marine officer. I didn't steal it, sir. He said, my guys need help. So he went with us. We found two other Marine alligators, and we took them out to the supply ship, and we put medical supplies in one, water in one, and ammunition in the other. And we started back in the beach, and we went to a slot in the coral reef, which had never been tested because the Japanese had owned the islands for 30, 40, 50 years, I don't know how long, and they would never let an American on the island, and they published nothing. So we had no idea how deep the water was when we went through there. So I went through this reef with these three tractors to a Japanese pier that was about 3 or 4 feet above waterline, and I pulled alongside. I told them that we couldn't go in the beach because the beach was just, the Japanese were dropping artillery on it. Just, it was horrible. I knew every time a shell hit, men were being killed or wounded. It was that bad. So I told them to throw the stuff on the dock, and they did. They started throwing the stuff on the dock, and the Japanese snipers started shooting at us, and the bullets were pinging off of the tractors. So I said, we got to get out of here. So they unloaded, and we started back, and we started back out through the slot. And my commander was sitting in this opening with a long pole, trying to find out how deep it was, to find out what size boats we could pull through there. And I started waving at him, telling him to turn and get the heck out of there. And finally, at the last minute, he finally figured out what I was doing, and he turned around and left. And I had sent the tractors through because they were slower. And then I came in behind him, and I don't think I was 100 yards through that slot until the Japanese artillery, which they had zeroed in on it apparently before, but their communications was terrible. They were terrible. So apparently they just got the word to fire. So when I looked back, the water looked like somebody had taken an egg beater and beat the water. It was just so many shells coming in. It was just foamy. If we'd been in there, we wouldn't have made it. But we got through there without any trouble.
So if your commander hadn't moved out of the way and you were still stuck there, you wouldn't be talking to me right now.
That's right. If he had just stayed there he'd have plugged up the channel because it wasn't very big for us to get through. Yeah.
How many of those close calls like that did you have? Because it seems like there were quite a few.
Oh, not many, I don't think.
Do you need your toes to count them?
Like I say, I had nothing but respect for the Marines. My job was so much easier than theirs. I thought they were the boys that needed to the hats off to.
Thing was, you kept volunteering to do more than just your job, as is evident from reading your book, The Gator Navy. And another thing I read in there with interest, because I've talked to a lot of guys who are on Saipan, a lot of them have discussed how disgusting and disturbing it was to them that so many civilians took their own lives there, jumping off that cliff because they'd been told lies about what Americans might do to them. And in your book, there's a pretty similar story there where you actually came upon some civilians who were contemplating that.
Well, after we moved on the beach, I left the ship and became part of the boat pool that was on the island. My friend Sid Cohen and I decided that we would go visit this commander that we had met on the LST and see if he made it. So we went over to Marine headquarters, and sure enough, he was there. And he said, the Japanese surrendered. He said, getting ready to go up the island. You want to go with us? We said, sure. And he said, what kind of a gun do you got? Well, we had our pistols and our holster. He said, those pea shooters that you're carrying, you need a man's gun. So went over to area where the Marines had behind the lines, where if a Marine were killed or wounded, they'd pick up his gun and bring it back to this place, and they would cannibalize these guns and put the guns together so that they had spare guns. So he had told this guy, pick out a couple of good guns for these swabbies. And so he gave us a couple of M1s, and so we got in the truck with him and took off. Went across the island and then up the other side. And about two-thirds of the way, three-quarters of the way up on the other side, we ran into some Marines. And there was a Marine major there. And so we pulled the truck over, and the colonel wanted to know what was going on. There was a group of Marines in a circle and had a little boy about 10, 12 years old, and they were just talking to him, and the kid was crying, and it was a mess. And the colonel started chewing on the major. What are you doing to this boy? And so we found out that this boy had come up and told the major there was some Japanese who wanted to surrender in a cave down by the water. So he'd sent a patrol down with this boy. When he got down, the Japanese ambushed and killed the whole patrol. So the Marines' buddies were not happy with this boy that had led them into this ambush. But they had some prisoners there, some civilians. And he said, you guys, would you take them with you to the prison camp? So the colonel volunteered us. So Sid and I had to get on the back of the truck with our M1s, and they put the prisoners in this truck. And we took off and went up around the end of the island. It was like a Western, something you'd see out of a Western movie. There were Japanese dead behind rocks, hanging over rocks, behind buildings. Some of them had tied themselves up in palm trees and then been shot out of the palm trees. They were hanging like dolls on the end of a string blowing in the wind. And we went around the end of the island, started down the other side, and all of a sudden we ran into a lot of Japanese civilians again. So the Japanese that we had in the truck started hollering and yelling in Japanese that we couldn't understand what it was. So we pulled over, and all these Japanese started running and jumping in the truck. They were packed in like sardines in there. And that was where they were jumping off the cliff, right there. They were jumping off this cliff, and to mothers and children holding hands and jumping in the water, killing themselves. They had been told that the Marines would kill them all, rape the women, and kill it. So they had no idea. So, but the Japanese in the truck that we had apparently saved lives by telling them, we were okay, don't jump. I know what they were saying. But anyway, when we pulled in, they all just swarmed into the truck. So we took all we could, and little did we know that that was the place where they were jumping in, the publicity we'd get in later years. But as we started on down the road, we finally came to a Marine roadblock. And the Marine came out, held his head up, and he came up to Colonel. He says, where in the so-and-so did you come from? And the colonel says, we came around the island. He said, don't you know that Japanese haven't surrendered yet? He said, well, I'd been told they'd surrendered. He says, no, they haven't surrendered yet. So we went behind the Jap lines all the way through them. I think the only thing that saved us the fact we had the Japanese civilians on the truck. And they were amazed at what are these guys doing here? Nobody ever fired a shot at us. So Finally, well, it was about 4 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, we got the official notice that the Japanese had surrendered.
So you didn't know you were saving their lives, and they didn't know they were saving your lives.
That's right. It was a mutual thing.
Isn't that something? Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories over the years, but I don't know too many situations where that kind of odd paradox existed. It's time for a break now on Hometown Heroes, but when we come back, we'll follow 93-year-old Victor Killingsworth from Saipan to Tinian. We'll relive some more close calls and maybe chuckle a little bit, too. I think you'll appreciate the creative nickname Vic and his Navy buddies had for one of the Pacific's top generals. And have you ever heard of a foxhole in the bottom of a boat? Right back with more of Victor Killingsworth's story when Hometown Heroes continues next after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.